Masters Universe.
Good evening and welcome to Paranexus Universe for Wednesday, March 16th, 2011. My name is Doug Kelly, and I'm here with Grant Rubin downstage.
Hey, Doug. Welcome, everybody. It's going to be a great show tonight.
Yes, it is. And, you know, I forgot last week. Last week was our 150th show. Of course, this is our 151st show. And those, of course, spread out over the last 3 years. I can't believe we've done that many.
Yeah. And then we only just had a short break.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, it's been a lot of fun. Still is.
Yeah. So, obviously, get to talk to a lot of interesting people, and tonight is no exception. Tonight we have Michael Schratt with us. I'll give a little bit about him in just a moment. If you would like to ask a question, you can join us in the chat room, or you can give us a call. We have Jamie Havikin screening our calls tonight. The numbers are on your screen, or you can use your Skype. Click the talk button there on the page if you want to call in. Tonight, Michael Schratt joins us. He's a private pilot, military aerospace historian. He currently works with Open Minds in Tempe, Arizona. Michael has lectured across the country on the unique subject of mystery aircraft and classified propulsion systems buried deep within the military-industrial complex. Michael has developed a number of contacts which have had first-hand experience dealing with classified black programs, including former USAF, that's the Air Force pilots, retired naval personnel, and aerospace engineers that have maintained a top-secret Q magic clearance. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be a part of your program.
Yes, interesting topic. Top secret classified.
Oh, it's right up our alley tonight, Doug. It's so nice to have you here, Michael.
Great, thank you.
Got about a million questions I want to ask you.
So let's get the conversation going. How long have you been doing it, and what got you into it?
I've been researching secret aircraft for about 16 years now. I just found it very interesting that there's a whole family of vehicles that are exempt from congressional oversight, no public scrutiny, and as being taxpayers, I think we have a right to know where our tax dollars are going.
Mm-hmm.
So I've made it my point to interview test pilots, engineers, military personnel who have worked on these programs, and by going through these sources, I put together a composite of what I believe is what's actually happening within the black world.
Well, cool. So let's talk about that. What do you think is happening?
Well, I'd like to, using the time that we have here, there's at least 16 programs I want to get into this evening.
Wow.
I think we'll consider the Bird of Prey, the A-12 Avenger II Test Blue Program, Northrop B-2 Stealth Bomber, Hudson Valley Boomerang, TR-3A Manta Ray, Sneaky Pete Program, something that happened at RAF Boscombe Down, U.S. Air Force Jet Disk Program, Southern Illinois Flying Triangle, North Sea Aurora, Brilliant Buzzard, F-19, Pulsar, or Flaming Pumpkin Sea, the Superstall, and the ARV. So that's just an example of some
just
of the
Just the tip of the iceberg, huh?
Yeah.
They've been busy. They've been very busy, little boys. And would you say that the 37B, is that like a little decoy to throw us even more off guard? Or what is the current state of our stealth technology?
That's a great question. And, you know, before we went on the air here, you were talking about the F-117 and that being released to the public. Well, the F-117 stealth fighter was acknowledged to the public on November the 10th, 1988. I mean, we're talking decades ago here. I mean, This is crazy. You're telling me that there's nothing going on between that time?
Mm-hmm.
Go back to Ben Rich. He was the former head of Lockheed Skunk Works between 1975 and 1991. And this is an interesting historical point. The night that Ben Rich retired from Lockheed Skunk Works, at his official retirement party, the F-117s took off to bomb Baghdad the very same night. It's just an incredible coincidence. So 1992, for example, September 22, 1992, Ben delivered a slide presentation at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and this is just one quote from Mr. Rich. It says here, quote, "We did the F-104, the C-130, U-2, SR-71, F-117, and many other programs that I can't talk about. We are still working very hard. I just can't tell you what we're doing." Directly from Ben Rich.
Hmm.
So they have, certainly there's a whole series of black aircraft programs that not only Lockheed has been working on, but also Northrop Grumman and Boeing Phantom Works. All three of these defense contractors are working on these type programs.
Do you think it's possible that these huge triangles we're seeing are kind of like some sort of sophisticated new blimp or something that they're using to for surveillance purposes?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I have in our collection here a 1976 report from McDonnell Douglas that highlights LTA craft or lighter-than-air vehicles, and some of these have a 400-ton cargo lifting capability over 600 feet per side. So essentially, directly from McDonnell Douglas, they're stating that the feasibility reports were done early on these gigantic diamond, omega, triangular, and dish-shaped lighter-than-air vehicles, so the next time you go out at night and you see one of these huge black triangles flying overhead, according to the report from McDonnell Douglas, it's more than likely one of ours.
Really?
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me at all.
Right, right. And we can back that up because there have been legitimate, absolutely legitimate sightings of these. For instance, in May of 2005, there was a report of a whole series of triangles flying over southern Illinois. This is in 2000, May of 2000. So there's documented cases of these birds flying all over.
Uh-huh. And are these the traditional ones with the lights in the corners or one in the middle?
Well, they can come in all different shapes and sizes. One eyewitness who saw these vehicles fly over said that he indicated that it looked like a two-story ranch fly right over his house.
Uh-huh.
So they can make them in almost any configuration. The most primary configurations are the boomerang, manta, or flying chevron shape.
Uh-huh.
And that can get into what may have taken place over the Hudson Valley, New York area between 1992
right.
and 1989. Over 25,000 eyewitnesses reported this gigantic boomerang-shaped craft that had multiple lights on the bottom of the craft. There were what looked like metallic and mechanical structure below the craft. And what's interesting, what I find very interesting, is eyewitnesses said that there were translucent panels on the bottom surface of the vehicle, allowing eyewitnesses to see up through the craft and see the truss beam construction inside the craft.
Oh, interesting.
So I just don't think that's an alien aircraft.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, the thing that gets me is, you know, you as a pilot, you know yourself that certain airspace is restricted. So these
sure.
big things, and if they're that huge, you know, what really would concern me if I was a pilot is you can't see the darn things. And so, like, if you're flying at night, so they must be flying them at a certain altitude, but you'd still think that it'd be awful darn scary.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, there is restricted airspace. And, you know, where do we begin with all this? We can begin with the Detroit Free Press article that was published February 8th, 1987. It says, "Secret ledger hides military projects. Pentagon black budget
uh-huh.
has tripled
uh-huh.
under the Reagan administration."
Uh-huh.
And in this article, they have a very interesting graph that just bottom line indicates that for fiscal year 1988, the Air Force's black budget was approximately $19.1 billion, and it has grown way out of control since that time. So clearly, there's a tremendous amount of aircraft procurement that has taken place.
Do you think?
Go ahead, Doug.
Do you think that one of these lighter-than-air craft of our own could have been responsible for the Phoenix sightings?
I think that's a possibility. That's clearly a possibility. We cannot discount it. We should never underestimate what has been done by the Lockheed Skunk Works, Air Force Plant 42, Palmdale. And also remember, too, that Jim Goodall, he lives in Hawaii. He's another interesting aircraft researcher. He's tracked Lockheed for years. He used to be very good friends with Ben Rich. And just before Ben Rich passed away in 95, he was successful in getting a telephone call into Ben just before he passed away. And this was going to be a non-holds-barred interview that they were trying to do. Unfortunately, Ben passed away, so that interview never took place. But he did get a final call in, and Ben Rich told Jim Goodall over the phone, quote, he said, "Jim, we have things that are 50 years beyond what you could possibly even dream of. If you've seen it on Star Trek or Star Wars, we've been there, done that, or decided it wasn't worth the effort." Directly from Ben Rich, 50 years in advance. So we've got it. Yeah. We've made the breakthrough. Yeah.
Well, you know, the thing that gets me is, what's the mission of the blimps? What's their mission?
Well,
why are they spying on us?
One of the mission requirements is to control the high ground, because he who controls the high ground controls the world. And so that's something the Air Force identified years ago. That's the first thing you need to do. And I personally believe that this has nothing to do with Osama bin Laden tracking terrorists. This is a bigger thing. This is much bigger than what we're being clued into. I mean, there's just, look at the procurement funding and building program that has been associated with deep underground military bases. If we're to believe Phil Schneider, there's over 142 deep underground military bases within the continental U.S. alone. Now, logic would tell you alone that that's way too many for the amount of political leaders we have. There's a discrepancy here. They're building way too many for the continuity of government. Something else is going on.
There's also a question from Jamie in the chat room. Do you think the Triangle sighting in Belgium in the 1980s were ours?
I do. I do. I absolutely believe it is ours, yes. Triangle craft are all the rage. There's a number of aircraft believed to be built out of the Tehachapi complex with Northrop, and you can go to their RCS range. It's not too far from Lancaster there, and that's where allegedly some of these craft or some of the components for the craft have been built. We've got some documented evidence to indicate that there is something called the TR-3B, which uses something called a magnetic field disruptor, and that essentially has a pressurized liquid mercury plasma that rotates at around 50,000 RPM, and it's pressurized, and there's an 89% reduction in the local gravity field. So that's something that we keep an eye on as well.
So let me make sure I understand. These triangular craft, with this propulsion system, they would be capable of zipping away pretty quick and emulating what we would call UFO type
activity. I want to state right up front that personally I believe, after looking at this for 15 or so odd years, 95% of what people are reporting as extraterrestrial UFOs are in point of fact our own deep black programs. And the January 5th, 2000 sighting of multiple triangular aircraft over southern Illinois area could have been lighter than air vehicles, which used a composite or hybrid electrogravitic propulsion system with a carbon fiber exoskeleton and a Kevlar exterior. And
like a lifter.
Kind of like that, yes. And you apply it to one side, and boom, you're gone. And it's incredible technology. We've got it. According to Ben, we've made the breakthrough.
So they must have obviously overcome the inertia issues, the G-force issues.
You're reducing your G-forces by 89% too, so you can make these 40G turns. And that's what was reported by the F-16 Belgian pilots when this thing departed. It departed at a tremendous rate of speed. No human pilot could ever sustain that amount of Gs, but using this technology, they can. They can. I mean, are we really to believe that in 1962, the A-12, which was built by Lockheed Skunk Works in Burbank under Kelly Johnson, it flew at Groom Lake in 1962, and then, you know, decades later, we're supposed to believe that that is still the top of the line aircraft? That's just a joke. It's a joke.
Yeah. Well, you also have to remember too that when they were when they were flying the U-2 and the SR-71 Blackbird, they were, you know, they were delighted when it was reported as a UFO.
Exactly.
They were absolutely delighted. As a matter of fact, I think with the U-2, from a historian's standpoint, I'm sure you agree with me, they were really happy that it was reported as a UFO.
That came out in Popular Mechanics about 10 years ago, that the CIA actually promoted that these U-2 and SR-71 flights were UFO sites sightings, because the CIA's mandate is to lie, deny, and deceive. That's their mandate.
Uh-huh.
You know, so actually that is what we're dealing with here. Now, just to get back to Boeing Phantom Works Bird of Prey, out of all these programs that we've discussed here, this is the only one. I find this very interesting. This is the only one that is Boeing proprietary. This program was not funded by taxpayers. This is a proprietary internal Boeing program. So you can't request a FOIA on this bird because it wasn't built with taxpayer money. $67 million were spent on this program.
Wow.
It did fly at Area 51. It was declassified, put into the public domain on October 18th, 2002. It is now at the Air Force Museum, Dayton, Ohio. But that was just one program. You know, they say that secrets can't be kept. They can be kept. No one knew about Bird of Prey until it was declassified under the Bush administration.
Huh. Well,
what was the Bird of Prey program?
The Bird of Prey was a low observable technology demonstrator that used a single piece composite aircraft construction with 3D virtual reality design components. And so it was kind of a proof of design concept, very low radar cross section, lower than the F-117. And by now, we're in third, fourth generation stealth technology. That's why we retired the F-117 in 2008. I mean, it's an arcane, obsolete museum piece right now.
Mm-hmm. What did they replace it with?
No one knows.
Ah.
No one knows. I mean, allegedly, it's the F-22. It's the stealth fighter, the Raptor, but it's beyond that. It's clearly beyond that.
Well, you know what's interesting about this? It kind of makes sense what you're talking about, especially with regard to the triangular aircraft or the triangular UFOs, quote-unquote, because those began to appear, what, in the 1980s?
Kind of, sure.
Out of the blue, almost. Now, all of a sudden, they've changed from traditional disc shape to triangular. And, you know, are we to think, well, either the aliens, you know, came out with a new model, or we're getting visited by a different species, or, you know, Occam's razor would suggest that they're ours.
Well, remember, too, the witnesses reported in the Hudson Valley sightings that the bottom of the craft had these translucent panels. So I ask everyone in these lectures, why in the world would aliens need translucent panels, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's something that we would need if we're landing VTOL, right? If we're landing a helicopter, we'd need to know where our landing area is, and that's how these craft operate. They have vertical takeoff and landing capability. So that's just another point in that direction.
Well, part of the stealth, too, if I recall, right, Michael, was at one point in time, weren't they trying to make the aircraft actually blend completely into the background with the type of it was either the color, or I'm trying to remember what it was, but, you know, essentially they did something, I think it was with light, and they changed it electromagnetically or whatever, and it would completely make that thing invisible. So I'm just wondering if we have that kind of technology, either it makes it look invisible, or it's not really invisible, but it's just so dark you can't see it.
You
can't get any definition of it at all, you know. So maybe, you know, because as you well know, both of you guys, self, sometimes simplicity is the key, you know. But
that's great. I'm glad you mentioned that. That was highlighted years ago in Popular Science, and they talked about electrochromic panels. What they were doing is they were electrically transferring the image of the background onto top surface of the craft, essentially allowing it to blend in with the background, making it invisible. That's what they were doing. This was years ago. Feasibility studies were done in, you know, 1995, upwards of that time frame.
Yep.
By now, it's totally in the field by now. So.
Oh, absolutely. It's probably old hat. And, you know, yeah. If they were working on that kind of stuff, it just really, it boggles your mind. I mean, and what here's the part that troubles me about this, too, because I'm a big aviation and aerospace, you know, fan. And, you know, if we've been duped for all this time, I mean, why are they duping us? You know, what's the purpose of it? I mean, we've been told, and we know, all three of us, that in order for this civilization to make the leap into becoming a space on our way, we need a single stage orbit vehicle, and the shuttle was never it. And I mean,
well, yeah,
tell me that. Call me crazy, but I bet they have several now.
Well, I mean, look at the space shuttle. Okay, we're still using obsolete liquid rockets.
Uh-huh.
Liquid rockets were used by the Nazis before World War II. Okay, yet we're still using this dinosaur technology. This is unprecedented. This is ridiculous. Another person that's interesting to keep in mind is Mr. Tom L. Keller. He's an author, lives in California. He was personally at one of Ben's last lectures back on 3/23/93 at the UCLA Alumni Club School of Engineering. And Ben was quoted as saying this, quote, "If you can imagine it, Lockheed Skunk Works has done it," end quote. So there's no limit to what the Skunk Works have been working on. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
Here's a question from the Inception Radio Network chat room, and we certainly welcome our listeners on Inception Radio. The question is, does Boyd, I believe Buckman, have anything else to say about
Bushman?
Have anything else to say about Skunk Works projects?
Huh. I've talked to this gentleman once, and I don't really have anything bad to say about him. He seemed like a nice guy, but the only thing I will say is, he speaks in metaphors. He speaks in very vague, nebulous terms, and you can't get a straight answer out of him. I'm sure he knows what's going on. You know, he worked under Ben Rich. He was a Lockheed Skunk Works engine. There's no doubt about that. Although multiple researchers have tried to breach this subject with him, yet he doesn't go into really specific details. He will give you this story about nature and how nature works, but he'll never give you any real technical details, and that's all I can say about Boyd Bushman.
So what's the next craft you...
Okay, the next craft on the list here is something called the A-12 Avenger 2. This is a very interesting story. This was a joint McDonnell Douglas General Dynamics program, and it was an all-weather attack aircraft designed to replace the A-6 Intruder. Two-seat tandem aircraft, a very low radar cross-section. This is a naval aircraft, so it was a carrier capable. But the only problem is, after years of R&D and, you know, so much work going into this, everyone's good friend Dick Cheney canceled the program on January 7th of 1991 at the cost of taxpayers of $5 billion, and we've got nothing to show for it. It's just...
No, tell me it isn't so. Tell me that isn't true. They wouldn't do that to us.
It's true. Unfortunately, it's true.
Yeah.
All we
scary,
have,
isn't it?
All we have is a broken down wooden mock up that's in Texas right now. It's just rotting away, and that's
right. And $5 billion went into that.
About government stimulus package and deficits and over out of control budget spending. They should take that $5 billion and cut us all a check, essentially, is what they should do.
Amen.
Yep. Yeah. It's
so
our money.
The bottom line on that.
And you know, the thing about it is, it's our money, and why aren't they telling us the truth? Because because they are separate from the government. They're a government unto themselves. And what's happened is, and I really think, you can call me paranoid if you wish, it's part of the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower talks about.
Right.
You know, he told us it was going to happen, and it did happen. And you know,
that's exactly correct.
It's just creeped in, and they're calling the shots, you know. And it's with that kind of money, they can do who knows what they're doing. It makes you wonder about some of the horror stories, you know. But nonetheless, something's going on in terms of the latest aircraft and developments in aviation, and, you know, we're certainly not getting any information about it.
Well, the fraud, waste, and abuse is completely out of control, because when you have a black program and you have a unacknowledged special access program, you have a blank check, and what you can essentially do is you can hide all your failures because of the black program. And that's how this goes. That's how this operates.
Yeah, it's under nobody. It's under somebody's supervision, but we don't know whose. And you know, and it sometimes it could be something porn. I mean, it could be something as wild and crazy as you know, like you know, getting atomic energy out of a hard-boiled egg or something. You know, I mean, I'm just going to the.
They've done that.
Well, they're working on it. It's only costing $3 trillion a year.
Yeah, well, that's a good buy.
But I mean, yeah, I mean, from the pragmatic to something that gets way off the deep end, I would think, you know.
So what's the next one on your list?
So let's talk about the Northrop Tacit Blue. This aircraft first flew in 1982. It was retired in 1985. And between 1985 and 1996, under the Clinton administration, in 1996, it was finally declassified. For over a decade, this was a classified black aircraft program that nobody knew anything about this. This is the first aircraft to use a quad-redundant fly-by-wire flight control system with a side-scanning radar. It's the same radar system used on the B-2 stealth bomber. And they call it by a number of different names. And it's also at the Air Force Museum, Dayton, Ohio.
Uh-huh.
It's been called the Whale. It's been called the Flying Loaf of Bread. And it's also been called the Flying Snow Shovel. So just another point, another example of secrets that can be kept.
Cool. There's a question in the chat room. How about the Hudson Valley sightings military?
We sort of covered that before, but that was a tremendous sighting that really is unprecedented. And well over 25,000 eyewitnesses saw it. So.
Cool. What's your next one on the
list? Let's consider... This is interesting. I always like to talk about the Northrop B-2 stealth bomber because, and I'll just throw it out there, does anyone there know how much each stealth bomber costs?
They don't want to.
Well, if I remember, I heard something like, what, a couple of billion or?
Right. It's $2.3 billion per aircraft. And, you know, they have to be stored in $100 million hangars, so you can add that on to it as well. But here's the interesting part of this. And I'm not making this up, and you can check it out. The reference is March 9th, 1992. Aviation Week Space Technology published an article, and the article title is called Black World Engineers Scientists Encourage Using Highly Classified Technology for Civilian Applications. And in this article, they interviewed a number of Northrop engineers who basically stated point blank that the Northrop B-2 electrically charges the leading edge of the wing to reduce the radar cross signature and then negatively charges the exhaust gases to reduce the infrared signature. Now, here's where it gets interesting because students of T. Townsend Brown will immediately recognize that this is nothing more than a flying capacitor.
Hmm.
Because when you positively charge the leading edge and negatively charge the trailing edge, you have a capacitor and there's a movement in the direction of the positive charge. And so, boom, right there, there was a... For decades, there's been talk about this being used on the B-2, and it's certainly a possibility because there have been reports that... When the B-2 returns on specific missions, the leading edge of the wing is glowing blue, which is a byproduct of this technology. The other thing is that a report done in 68 by Northrop indicated that when you electrically charge the leading edge of the wing, you can reduce the aircraft's drag coefficient by up to 60%, thereby saving fuel consumption of 50%, which is unbelievable. Unbelievable.
So a question in the chat room is, so who does all this stuff benefit?
Who does all this benefit? Well, the easy answer is the defense contractors, right? They're the ones cashing in on all this.
Yep.
I mean, there always has to be a threat, right? Reference Carol Rosen, who talked about this. Von Braun had talked about this, that there would be these generated enemies, these, quote, manufactured enemies, so that the military-industrial complex would have an excuse to build weapons of mass destruction, and this is all part of it. There's got to be. Now that the Cold War is over, what are we going to do? We've got to manufacture a new threat, so now we've got the ambiguous terrorist threat.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know,
but didn't they also say that the last one would be when the threat is from off the earth.
Correct.
That's like DEFCON 4 in their lingo. What a scary sort of thing to think about, you know. And what's really even scary is that they hijacked our democracy along with these big corporations. They hijacked it right under people's noses, and then they play tricks with the people, you know. Oops, I'm getting on my soapbox, but the games are played, and it's just really too bad because, you know what, that technology is there. It could be used for transportation. It could be used to really kind of commercialize space and maybe clean up our space and do a few things, and it's just going to waste over idiotic, spying and fighting.
Well, think about what's going on right now in Japan. We've got essentially the meltdown of 3 nuclear reactors.
It's
essentially confirmed
too horrific
that they have
to
melt down. Yet the military-industrial complex, specifically Air Force Plant 42, they have already tapped into the zero-point energy field. They know how to access and amplify that. It's an unlimited supply of electrically charged particles. And why aren't they using that technology instead of this ridiculous nuclear reactors? There's the tragedy right there.
Well, is somebody going to come on and be our savior? Is somebody going to, you know, when things get so bad that all of a sudden there's a new savior on the horizon so that we can move from the oil gods to the, you know, zero-point energy gods? You know, because it doesn't matter if it's free, you know, you guys know that. They're going to charge us. They'll find a way.
Sure.
Here's a question from the chat room. What role did Edward Fuch play in the topic?
He was a guy who came on the scene right around 96, I believe, and he did go to the International UFO Congress years ago. He gave a lecture there, one time only. He was vilified by the ufology community, and he's since sort of dropped off the radar screen. He's the one who broke the story on the TR-3B. It was never 100% conclusively proved that that aircraft did exist. There was no, you know, serious documented physical evidence presented that it did exist, but if you look at all the sightings reports, they mimic exactly what Fouché was talking about. Plus, if you go back to the Sanskrit text from India, they talk about Vimana aircraft that use toroid pressurized liquid mercury rotation.
Yep.
And it's the exact same technology that Edgar Fouché talks about. So,
So is there any nuclear-powered aircraft on your list?
I believe that the Hudson Valley may have been one of the nuclear-powered aircraft. And see, that's another reason why they keep this under wraps, because the U.S. government doesn't want to let the public know that there's a nuclear reactor flying over their heads every night.
Okay.
You know, that's certainly a possibility.
Well, why should we worry?
Why should we worry?
You know,
right.
Why should we worry about that? They know best,
which is really
bad for us. But you know what, without skipping ahead, where are we at as far as, you know, like, here's what I'm curious about, and this is probably much old hat to you, Michael, is was Aurora a real project, and what is the state of Aurora now, if it has been in existence for a while?
That's a very good question, and there's really no one good answer. First of all, I would present that Aurora was technically never the name of a particular aircraft. It was perhaps the name of a family of aircraft, and this starts by the August 1989 sighting of a completely black isosceles triangle by Chris Gibson from the Galveston Key oil drilling platform. And what he saw, this is a 100% reliable report. He was part of the Royal Observers Corps. He saw a KC-135 fly overhead. Flanked on the port side of the KC-135 were two F-111s with their wingspans, wings retracted out. And then directly behind the KC-135 was a black triangle. It had kind of a featureless bottom. He couldn't see any of the details on top. But it was flying directly behind the KC-135, or believed to have been being refueled. And so the bottom line is that there are at least 3 aircraft that fall under this Aurora-type program. One is this aircraft that Chris Gibson saw. Another aircraft, which was seen at a classified dog and pony show to garner support for military black programs on November the 12th of 1988 at Norton Air Force Base, has been termed the Pulsar or the Flaming Pumpkin Seed. And just a real quick description about that aircraft. It was about 100 feet long. This is a well-documented case. 100 feet long, 65 feet wide, unmanned aircraft, tricycle landing gear. The entire exterior of the vehicle was composed of heat-ablative thermal-resistant tiles taken directly off the space shuttle. There were a series of two NACA air intakes on either side of the center line of this craft. It had control surfaces along the leading and trailing edge, and then just along the mid portion of this craft, there were these hundreds of tiny fuel injector nozzles. And just to make a really long story short, when the turbojets inside this aircraft get this bird up to about Mach 3, the leading edge starts glowing red hot. They switch off the engines. They turn them off completely. They close these NACA air intakes shut. And then by way of those fuel injector nozzles, they start introducing a modified liquid methane fuel with a boron-based additive directly into the superheated shockwave. And when that happens, it immediately expands and compresses between the superheated shockwave and the tapered afterbody of the aircraft, pushing it across the sky at about 12,000 miles an hour.
I believe that.
So we do...
And, so 12,000, that's like what, Mach 10?
I think that's around Mach 12. Yeah, 12,000 miles an hour, yeah, that's somewhere in the Mach 10 range, right? It can go from Catalina Island to Hawaii in 15 minutes.
Wow.
It's clocked at that speed.
Well, you know, I didn't realize we had aircraft that could do that.
Well, we're, you know, for the public, they think, like, I mean, like, what about, you know, the, what is it, the scramjet, the H-43 or whatever, the 34, or I'm losing it now, Hypershot or High Shot, the one that the Australians were doing, that's, like, supposed to be if we've got that technology that they claim is, that we haven't even worked on yet, and which I have good reason to believe they do, you know, that's really sophisticated stuff. And it sounds like what you just described, Michael, is that they've contained what they tried hard to do in a scramjet. They said it was like keeping a match lit in a hurricane. They kind of got that taken care of with that type of design that you're talking about.
Yeah, there's no moving parts here whatsoever. As soon as they shut down those turbojet in, there's no moving. It's an external burning type propulsion system. And the other side point about this is that on the lower surface of this vehicle, there were 121 nuclear launch tubes, each containing a 1/10 megaton warhead that could be launched in 1/10 of a second.
Oh, beautiful.
So
charming.
18 of these aircraft were built during the Reagan administration. And this is the secret that they don't tell you about the Cold War, is when Mikhail Gorbachev and his military brass got a sneak peek of some of these aircraft. They basically threw up their hands and said, you know what, gentlemen, we're done. There's no way we can retrofit our radar ranges to track these aircraft, and that was the end of the Cold War.
Interesting. That's how it ended. Okay, so what's your next aircraft?
Okay, so we've talked about that. We should also spend, and this is another one of those birds. There is an aircraft out there. I've been after this aircraft for a long, long time. It's believed to be called the TR-3A Manta Ray. Some have called it the Black Manta. That's not the name of it. It's called the Manta Ray. This is a single-seat reconnaissance, digital real-time reconnaissance aircraft bomb damage assessment. It absolutely did fly along with the F-117s during Desert Storm. There were 19 of these aircraft built, and this is a very low-radar cross-section aircraft, and it's believed that McDonnell Douglas was the prime contractor. Teledyne Ryan in San Diego was a subcontractor of this aircraft. It was at Tonopah Test Range back in 1982 through 1984, in that time period, with the F-117s, and this aircraft is still classified to this day.
Wow.
Wow, so it kind of escorts in. It escorted, used to escort them in?
It flies with the Blackbirds.
Was it like decoy?
F-117. No, it wasn't really a decoy, but it was a bomb damage assessment
digital. Oh, okay, so it would like
reconnaissance aircraft.
I got it. So maybe it would automatically. It was just targeting the same trajectories and everything else, and just wow, what a cool idea.
Yeah, it's a great aircraft, but yet for some reason, and I don't know why, we have the the F-117 being acknowledged on November the 10th of 1988. Then, a week or so later, we have the Northrop B-2 stealth bomber that's rolled out of Air Force Plant 42 Palmdale on November 22nd, 1988. Now, this is so long ago. Why in the world is the Manta Ray still classified? Why? It just doesn't make any sense. How can the Manta Ray be more classified than the B-2 stealth bomber? I've sent in FOIA requests up and down through the government. They will not acknowledge this aircraft.
They're not gonna. They got something hot, and they're not gonna talk about it at all. There's been a breakthrough, you know, and maybe they've been working on it. Maybe they finally got it refined enough so that, you know, things have changed significantly. But you know what? It's no secret to anybody else. And what's surprising? They're keeping it. If the Chinese would certainly know about it. They would most certainly know or at least be
suspicious.
Yes, I would think.
Sure.
Yeah, you know? And right. Because they're becoming more sophisticated with their aerospace and everything else. But wow, that would be a big jump. And what's even more disturbing is their absolute arrogance in not wanting to share that technology with us.
Sure. Sure.
Well, you know, it could be that whatever technology the Manta Ray uses, if discovered, could lead to more advanced engineering or something
or
like that.
Or cheaper forms of energy other than oil.
That's certainly a possibility.
Yeah, folks might go for that.
What's your next plane?
So the next aircraft on the list is something called the Sneaky Pete aircraft. This one hit home to me because I sent in a FOIA request under the new, quote, Obama transparency on government policy, and there is no transparency on government. You can forget about any FOIA requests. It's not going to happen. They won't do it. It's worse than the Bush administration.
Really?
So
that's interesting.
Anyone who's trying to send in a FOIA request, you can cease and desist because it's not going to get you anywhere. The only way to make any progress with any of these aircraft are to go directly to the contractor themselves, and that's what I did with the Sneaky Pete. This was a technology demonstrator built by a company called Pass Research of Santa Paula, California, back in 1982. Dick Rattan was the test pilot of this aircraft. His first
spaceship one.
Personally, he confirmed it for me. July 18th, 1982 was the first test flight at Mojave Airport. Mike Melville has also flown this aircraft, confirmed by him personally. What this is, it was basically, and this is kind of like bare bones technology here, this is a predecessor to today's UAVs and UCABs. It was designed as a UAV, a remotely controlled UAV with a pilot backup, and that's what this was. So it was the forerunner of today. It looks like a long easy, just slightly different than a long easy. And
not sure what that is.
Area 51. It doesn't look exotic, really. It looks like a standard long easy, but what's historically interesting about it is it has flown at Area 51, and it is still a black aircraft. And so I went directly to the contractor. He sent me a photo of it.
Really?
Yep. And if you go on openminds.tv, you can see a photo of it.
That's openminds.tv?
Openminds.tv, yes. There are multiple articles on there talking about black aircraft. If you go on the upper right-hand screen, just type in my name in there, and all my articles will pop up, and you can see, you'll see the picture of that aircraft.
Cool. All right, what's the next one?
Okay.
15 minutes left.
We should also discuss something known as the U.S. Air Force Jet Flying Wing Disc Program. This was a man by the name of Jack D. Pickett, who was a retired naval combat veteran. He passed away a couple of years ago. He was a publisher at MacDill Air Force Base, which is near Tampa, Florida.
We know all about that. That's close to us.
Of 1967, yes, September 1967, he saw four of the most incredible aircraft that he had ever seen at the base scrapyard. The aircraft measured 20, 40, 70. The largest one was 116 feet in diameter. They all had tricycle landing gear. There was a crew compartment dead center on the disc. The fuselage tapered back to an extremely high vertical tail. And he was just astounded. So he talked to the person in charge there. He was supplied with 16 officially stamped U.S. Air Force government photographs of these aircraft and was just about ready to publish a full-page spread article on these with all these photos stamped by the Air Force official. And there was an overflight of a VTOL aircraft that took off from Avon Park. You guys might know where Avon Park is, right?
Yep.
I think it's southeast of that area. And this thing dropped down to treetop level over downtown Miami, and the next day Jack picked up the Tampa Morning Tribune and brought it into the general's office there, and it was decided that it would be in the better interest of the Air Force to delay publication of the JETTIS program. So generally that's the gist of that whole thing, but the bottom line is that the U.S. Air Force was in possession and did test fly a series of horizontal takeoff jet flying wing discs, and they suffered from stability problems, and they were scrapping them at the scrapyard.
Well, they've always had that kind of an issue with the disc shapes, right? The stability issues?
Yes, there's a stability issue.
Well, obviously.
Be very careful. That's why they had a huge vertical tail at the back. And the one that took off from Avon Park was a VTOL, perhaps Project Silverbug, that did away with that problem. So they were able to solve that issue.
The stability issue?
Yep, the stability issue was solved with the VTOL design. Huh. There may have been, I will repeat this very carefully, there may have been a supplemental propulsion system associated with that disc craft that was connected to the U.S. Air Force, Navy, and Atomic Energy Commission back in 1960. Program actually started in 1946, something called the NEPA program. That's Nuclear Energy for Propulsion of Aircraft. And the mandate of that program was to explore the feasibility of atomic and nuclear-powered aircraft and spacecraft. And I think that the hybrid propulsion system that may have been involved with the aircraft that Jack Pickett saw at MacDill, they may have employed that propulsion technology.
Interesting. All right, what's the next one?
Okay, the next one, and this has never been talked about in American press. There is no reference to this anywhere in any of the aerospace literature, none of the trade publications. Aviation Week Space Technology has never talked about this. I had to go across seas to get this from Air Force's Monthly, March 1997. This is an event that took place at RAF Boscombe Down, September 26, 1994. This is a true account. There was a crash of one of our stealth aircraft. It was not the F-117. This is believed to be called the Northrop Astra, and this is about a Mach 4, very stealthy aircraft, high altitude. It looks like a YF-23 with twin inward-canted vertical stabilizers, and on the application of military power, it's believed that there was a nose gear malfunction, and it crashed, you know, onto the runway with the nose pointed down. They towed it back to the hangar, and then within 24 hours, a C-5 Galaxy picked up the aircraft and flew it back to Air Force Plant 42, heading toward Northrop's facility. And it's never been talked about in American press. This may have been the aircraft that Chris Gibson had seen years earlier. We can't make that connection totally, but it may have been one of those type aircraft. So that's never been talked about in American press.
Well, cool. So we've got about 10 minutes left. What else we got on our list?
Okay, we also should talk about the Brilliant Buzzard program. That was the third aircraft in the, quote, Aurora program. This is essentially confirmed by a man by the name of John Andrews. He used to be the senior project design engineer at Testers Model Corporation, and he was a very good friend of Ben Rich. And over a series of years, they played this gentleman's Scrabble game where they would go back and forth, and John would ask Ben these questions about configurations of stuff. And Ben would, you know, confirm and kind of like correct things here and there. They finally came up with a very interesting configuration that somewhat looked like a stretched SR-71, but instead of having the vertical stabilizers, you would take those vertical stabilizers and bring them out toward the wingtips. And so now you have an aircraft that has winglets and it has retractable canards. It is a three-seat aircraft. There's a pilot a co-pilot, and a launch control officer. He is the liaison between the mothership and the parasitic aircraft. So what we're talking about here is a two-stage to orbit space plane concept program. The third officer in this mothership, he sits aft so that he can see what's going on. And so this is believed to be the third aircraft involved in this Aurora program. And the
parasitic aircraft,
yes, he also has the capability to take off at Groom Lake.
Mm.
And what's interesting here, though, is that the aircraft that have been seen at Groom Lake and heard at Groom Lake, because they used a pulse detonation, combined cycle pulse detonation wave engine, the takeoff roll is 9,000 feet, okay? And anybody who knows anything about aircraft takeoff rolls, you need to have three times the amount of the takeoff roll. And so what's the runway length at Groom Lake? It's 27,000 feet. And that's why they expanded the runway at Groom Lake to 27,000 feet, because if your takeoff roll requires 9,000 feet and you have an emergency, you need a whole long overrun to stop that aircraft due to an emergency. And that's why we have 27,000-foot runway at Groom Lake.
Why would it require 9,000 foot?
Because you have a heavy aircraft with a low lift coefficient triangular blended wing configuration that doesn't do you much good for slow flight. You have a long takeoff run. Long takeoff run. You have a 75-degree swept wing configuration. That's not good for low airspeed. That's good for hypersonic Mach 5, Mach 10, but not for 120 knots.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to accelerate up to maybe 250 knots or so, maybe even beyond that, just to take off. And if you need to slam the brakes, you're going to have a long rollout. So that's exactly what we have.
Now, on the previous plane that you just talked about that crashed, where did it crash? Question from you.
This was at RAF Boscombe Down. This is back in 94.
In the UK?
In the UK, that's right. That's right. So that has just, I found it just amazing that it has just never been talked about. I don't know why. Maybe they really want to keep it under wraps. But for some reason, Avweek did not cover it, and it's never been declassified.
How high are these vehicles operating at, Michael?
Well over 150,000 feet.
Wow.
Well over, because that aircraft that I described that uses the external burning, they use a boron-based additive into the liquid methane, and that's used as kind of an oxygen supplement, because there's no oxygen way up there. So that's why they put the boron into the fuel so it burns. That's exactly what they're doing.
All right. What's the next? How many planes we got left in the aircraft?
Oh, well, we've got something called the Superstall, and this was part, just kind of go over this story quickly. In 1988, there was a dog and pony show to garner support for black programs at a place called Norton Air Force Base near San Bernardino, California. During the Thunderbird demonstration, IFR conditions prevailed at the time. The lead Thunderbird pilot called off the air show. I've got the actual newspaper clipping that confirms that. It did take place. There was an air show exhibit there. The Thunderbirds were flying, 100% confirmed. Essentially, it says right here, poor visibility shortens Thunderbird show, Norton flyby finale. In the large hangar at Norton Air Force Base, there were a number of classified aircraft that were there. This is confirmed in Aviation Week Space Technology, December 24th, 1990, so you can check this out. One aircraft that was present was the Pulsar that we already talked about. There was another aircraft called the Superstall. This is a single pilot marine attack aircraft, sort of a ground support attack aircraft. It uses a conventional heads-up display that's ripped off from an F-16. It has outrigger landing gear. It has a conventional tail arrangement. There's a small miniature turbofan engine on either side of the pilot's area. This turbofan engine, it kind of tapers back to an extremely interesting configuration of a platypus exhaust port, and it has the capability of blowing the jet exhaust over what are called these Venetian blind wing panels that look like Venetian blinds, and they're made out of a heat-resistant metal called Inconel. And what the pilot can do is he can change the angle of attack of these Venetian blinds from 0 to 45 degrees, and by way of the Coanda effect, this thing can take off vertically. And so that was another aircraft that was part of this display.
Okay. How many aircraft we got left on your list?
Now, the
He's
final
got too many to count.
The final one that we want to talk about here. Now, the back line of this is that it appears that there was a B portion to this exhibit. So we've got one taking place at the Norton Air Force Base big hangar, and anyone who lives near Norton knows exactly what I'm talking
Where's
about.
Where's that at?
It's a series, San Bernardino, California.
Okay.
And they all know exactly what I'm talking about. There's a series of Quonset-style huts there. They actually call them the big hangar. Now, independent from the Norton exhibit, there was another B portion of this exhibit that it believed to have been taking place at the L-1011 hangar at Lockheed Skunk Works facility, Air Force Plant 42, Palmdale. So we've got one at Norton, one at Skunk Works in Palmdale. Inside the big hangar there at Lockheed Skunk Works, and separated by a black curtain, I've got this confirmed by three independent sources. There were three flying saucers on display, okay? They were called alien reproduction vehicles. They also were called fluxliners because they operated on the principles of high-voltage electrical charges. They measured 24, 60, 130 feet in diameter. They were all hovering off the floor. No supporting structure, no wires, no strings, nothing below it. They were bobbing on their own type gravity field, just like you would see a big ocean liner bobbing in a harbor, you know, where it kind of goes up and down.
Huh.
Now, to describe the interior components and the exterior, the upper crew compartment along the exterior had six CCD cameras and one on top. They were all ripped off from the Vegas casinos, and this was using off-the-shelf components that were readily available within the aerospace industry. They could all be slewed in conjunction, and they produce an artificial image on the inside of the pilot's visor, just like the Apache helicopter display.
That's
wow.
An artificial display for the vision system. The ejection seats, and there were four of them on the smaller craft, which had a number of these composite panels removed, they were ripped off from the F-4 Phantom. So that's the seat ejection system. There was an articulated arm on the bottom, and there was a series of capacitor plates on the lower section of this vehicle. And essentially, to make things very short and brief here, what they did is they took a high-voltage electrical charge, they fed it into the 12-foot diameter Tesla coil. When that happens, there's a magnetic field that forms above this craft in the form of a toroid donut. And by way of a rheostat device, the pilot had the capability of overlaying these fuel lines onto these capacitor plates, causing picture on roll. And that's how this thing flew.
Well, that's interesting. Well, I'll tell you what, a lot of interesting aircraft out there, and it's been a bit of an eye-opener for me, too, so I appreciate that. Michael, would you let everybody know your website once more?
Sure, website is openminds.tv.
Cool. Openminds.tv. Hey, we really appreciate you coming on the show tonight and sharing
your obvious. Yeah, and you've got such a wealth of data, you know. We'd like to have you back, you know,
sure.
Because I've enjoyed your information tremendously tonight, and I'm sure our audience
Thank
has
you.
As well.
Hey, in about 10 seconds or less, a quick question from the chat room. Do you think or know if Magic or Majestic 12 is real?
Well, the only thing I can say about that is reference what Dan Burrish had talked about. Just gave a lecture of that at the International UFO Congress here in Scottsdale. I would just reference that you can pick up that report from openminds.tv. Just type in Project Aquarius. He stated that he was a part of Majestic, so I will just refer to that report.
That's a good quick answer. And we appreciate everybody in our chat room tonight joining us, as well as those listening to the archive. Please join us next week. We're going to talk about UFO files, and we've got other shows, of course, coming up. Please visit us at paranexus.org. Thanks to Jamie Havikin for training our and Kevin McLeod for the music. for Grant and myself. Have a great weekend.
Hey, everybody. Have a nice weekend. Bye-bye.
Good night.